order today. I want to start off today by welcoming our two new members. We have newly appointed Senator Mark Hass at the end here, who has served very honorably in the House in the past, including on the Revenue Committee. So we will completely welcome his experience and perspective on the committee. And then sitting next to him is our rogue senator, from the rogue area, of course, Senator Atkinson, who is an accomplished cyclist and fly tire, and also is who is just, I believe this is your first time on Revenue, Jason, correct? So he's our newbie, and so we'll be running all the complicated things by Senator Atkinson. So welcome to both of you. Okay, we're going to start out today by opening a work session for possible bill introduction. Mr. Warner.
Madam Chair, as committee members will recall, we did request three bill drafts. We have one of them before you, which is LC 33. And this is a clarification of a credit that was passed during the 07 session, part of the House Bill 3201 omnibus bill, for TRICARE physicians providing TRICARE insurance. There was a question over how the credit was calculated. We had had discussions with the Office of Rural Health, who is administering the program, and the feeling was there needed to be a clarification to make it consistent with how the bill was interpreted at the time of passage. So that's what this bill does. Chris has been working on it, if there are any questions that you have.
Okay. Senator Starman, we should start with a motion on this.
I move to approve the introduction of the bill. How's that?
That's very good. Senator Starr moves to introduce LC 33 as a Senate Finance and Revenue Committee bill for the 2008 session. Is there any discussion or any questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, this is a very important clarification. There was it was clear the intent when we passed this bill that it be up to 500 per year. And there was some that interpreted the original bill language that would be just 500, and that it would be the same 500. And so this makes it real clear that it's 500, and then an additional up to 500, and so on, to take care of the medical needs for our veterans. This is a very important clarification of a very important piece of legislation that we passed in the 07 session.
Thank you for that explanation. Any other discussion or questions? Okay. Are there any objections? Okay. That was introduced. Now, committee, we have two other bills that we are supposed to introduce, and they are not ready yet. So that our deadline is the 18th. So that means that we're in the position of having to have another meeting before the 18th to introduce those bills. The good news is that we can do it, except for me, who I will come here, but we can do it by phone. And the House Revenue Committee meets next week, next Thursday, the 17th, in the morning. So I thought if we could do it in the afternoon at 2:30, we won't set that in stone right now, but if you could just look at your schedules, and all we need is a quorum. Correct, Paul?
That's correct, yes.
And it'll be a very, very short meeting. You can do it in person or you can do it by phone.
What was the day, Jenny?
Thursday the 17th at 2:30.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
On Senator Monroe.
I believe Full Ways and Means is meeting at that time, and I'm on Full Ways and Means, so it might be a problem for me.
Yeah. Well, actually, that might be good because it's probably going to take 3 minutes.
Okay, well, then they can come and get me out of Full Ways and Means,
yeah.
And I can do my...
Yeah, I'll be in the governor's office, so I can come down for that, too.
Perfect. Okay, I smell a quorum, so let's put that in stone for the moment, and if anything comes up, just let me know as quick as you can. Okay.
Madam Chair, just to remind the committee what those bills are. The first is a reconnect. And while we didn't see major federal changes, there's still technical reasons to reconnect to federal law through 123107. And the other one was to direct Department of Revenue to estimate the personal corporate income tax gap and make recommendations to the 2009 legislature on how to close that gap. So those are the requests that we made, and that's what the bills will refer to.
Okay. Let's see.
That's Chris.
Okay, our next agenda item, and we're actually ahead of schedule, despite the rain, will be an analysis of federal income tax actions, and Chris Allenette will be our expert on this. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenette, Legislative Revenue Office. And I was just going to provide an update on federal tax legislation that passed in 07 and kind of talk about how we, just to refresh everybody's memory, how we connect to federal law. And as Paul mentioned, there weren't any, there don't appear to be any major bills that were passed in terms of a major, in terms of revenue impact, but there are, were, I've identified at least five bills that did pass federal tax legislation that would have some kind of impact, some automatically through our rolling reconnect, and then I'm still exploring the other connections. Just by way of background, the way Oregon connects to federal law, any federal tax law change can have an impact on Oregon either directly or indirectly. Directly, it would be if federal legislation changes type of income that is taxed, or that would be the most direct way. The indirect way would be through the Oregon's federal tax subtraction. So anything that changes federal law and changes the federal liability affects Oregon's tax law kind of in a reverse manner. So if federal taxes increase for a taxpayer, then that increases their federal tax subtraction, which would reduce their Oregon tax liability. But most of the federal legislation here I'm going to be talking about today is through the direct tie to federal, and that connection is via two mechanisms. First is through the definition of taxable income, to which we have a rolling reconnect. We are constantly reconnected to federal taxable income. All other definitions in federal law we have to connect to as of a specific date. And as you recall in the 07 session, you passed a bill that connected us to federal law as defined December 31st, 2006. And that always has to be in the past. It can't be prospective as per the Constitution. The five bills that I've identified so far that affect federal taxes, again, there weren't any major issues in them, but I just wanted to briefly touch on each of those. And they're listed in that first part on the one-page handout there. And the first bill was the Small Business and Work Opportunity Tax Act that was passed in late May of 07. And that did just a few things. The biggest piece in terms of revenue impact was an extension of Section 179 expensing. Businesses, when they purchase machinery and equipment, they depreciate that over the life of the equipment. That's kind of the baseline law. What Section 179 allows is for an expensing of that equipment. And the prior law allowed businesses to expense up to $100,000. So if a business purchased equipment that costs up to $100,000, they could take that entire deduction in that first year. They didn't have to depreciate it over the life of the equipment. And most of this benefit, because of that limitation, accrues to smaller businesses. It's not going to accrue to the larger businesses, although they can take it as well. And what the 07 legislation did was expand it and extend it. It had been scheduled to sunset the end of 07, and it has been extended through 2010. And it has been increased to $125,000 deduction in 07 and then $128,000 deduction in 2008, and then it's indexed for inflation. And so right now in federal law, that's the level of that deduction through 2010. and as that sunsets, and I'll get to this a little bit more later, that expensing deduction reverts to pre-2001 law, or only $25,000. So it gets dramatically reduced in 2011 under current law. Now, that is a deduction, so that flows through to taxable income, and so Oregon businesses are automatically connected to that. And that is probably has the largest revenue impact, and that was about $15 million, a $15 million loss in 07-09, and an $8 million gain in 09-11, and a $6 million gain in 11-13. And again, that's just a shifting of when those deductions occur, rather than over time they're kind of bunched up. And again, you don't have to pass any law for that revenue impact to occur. It has already occurred with our rolling reconnect to the definition of taxable income.
One thing I might add, too, in the forecast, these should be built into the forecast because they're in effect current law.
So was it built into the last forecast?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
A couple of the other smaller items that bill affected, it changed the work opportunity tax credit, which is a federal credit, and it extended that credit through August of 2011, and it also expanded that credit to targeted groups such as high-risk youth and certain veterans. There were also a number of S-Corp provisions, and then there were a couple of small revenue raisers at the federal level. And most of those don't really affect Oregon. For example, the Work Opportunity Tax Credit doesn't affect Oregon directly. The next piece of legislation, the other four all passed and were signed into law right around Christmas time. There was a flurry of activity before Congress went home for the session, for the break. And the Energy Independence and Security Act had, up to a point, a number of tax provisions that were promoting energy independence. A lot of them affected, there were various depreciation pieces for energy-related equipment. There were some biodiesel, alternative fuel, alternative energy, alternative fuel vehicle credits, and things like that. All of that was stripped out at the last minute. And then in the end, there was just one small piece of legislation that might affect Oregon, and that had to do with a 7-year amortization of expensing for oil companies. Now, and at most, that's going to have a very minor impact for Oregon because we don't have any oil companies headquartered here, but with the multi-state nature of those companies, there is a small piece of revenue that does flow into Oregon, and that does, there is likely to be some small impact there. Again, that is through the rolling reconnect, so no action needs to be taken for that. This is also the bill where the biggest, from a policy perspective, it increased the CAFE standards from 25 miles per gallon to 35 miles per gallon by 2020. So that was the core of that legislation. The next bill, the Mortgage Forgiveness and Debt Relief Act.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Can I ask a question before you move on to that?
Sure.
Oregon, in the first 8 days of this year, we already exceeded our 07 year when it came to business energy tax credits and all that work that we did last session. One of the major concerns in the industry right now is the failure of Congress to strip out all the renewable energy tax credits that will end in 08. Do you have any indication of what, or forecast of what might happen? I believe Congress probably will come back to session next year and extend that further, but to me that has a huge revenue impact on the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, unfortunately I don't have a crystal ball to know exactly what Congress will do. That's rather difficult to predict, but I do believe you're right in that they will address the issue again, and that it's likely that some form of legislation will pass. Exactly what nature that will be, that's hard to predict, and we do follow that. To keep an eye on.
Well, what that's created, Madam Chair, is a huge stampede for the first 6 months of this year, and then a lot of investment that was planned on coming into Oregon probably will not come into Oregon if those federal tax credits aren't put back into place. Mm-hmm. So we did our work with the Oregon Betsy and then the federal government lit down their end of the bargain, so we could go into next year in 2009 without that federal and see all the renewable energy work that we've done off that.
But for the record, the revenue impact, it might have impact on businesses coming here and indirectly, but the actual revenue impact is positive, correct, for state income tax collections, because less is being deducted from the federal tax burden if they're not renewed, correct?
Madam Chair, they're kind of both effects. You have the direct and the indirect, and you're right in the direct in terms of lowering the tax liability, with any lowering of the federal tax liability. But if I'm following the Senator correctly, it's just the general demand and supply of locating these businesses and expanding the businesses in the state, which the federal credits can play a part in.
Let me rephrase the statement and delete new businesses coming in here. Renewable projects going on existing businesses in Oregon will greatly slow down because the federal incentive is so important to offset the investment when it comes to our low utility rates.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
The Mortgage Forgiveness and Debt Relief Act, and this was in response to the subprime lending and the mortgage crisis going on in the country. And the biggest piece of this was an exemption for debt forgiveness for tax years of 07, 08, and 09. The backdrop to that is that when you have a taxpayer who owes a certain amount of debt and that debt is forgiven, that is considered taxable income and should be reported on the tax return. So, for example, you have somebody who has $2,000 of debt, and the debt is restructured, or say $10,000 of that debt is forgiven. Then that $10,000 is reported on the taxpayer's return, and it counts as income and is taxable. That's kind of the backdrop. Now, but for this law, in these cases where taxpayers have gotten into a bind with their mortgage and part of their mortgage is forgiven, this law says that does not count as taxable income. And so that's the tax break.
And the policy reason was because the people are already in financial dire straits anyway, or was there another reason?
Madam Chair, that was largely they're in very difficult positions in the likelihood of losing homes and just in terms of those dire straits, and then adding a tax liability onto that to income that wasn't really provided in a tangible sense. It was income in the sense of you no longer owe X amount of dollars.
Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
It's my understanding that that will not have as great an impact in Oregon as in some other parts of the country where there's been a rapid decline in home values.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe that's correct, and I'm still looking at that to determine what the revenue impact would be for Oregon, but I believe that's correct. We haven't seen the foreclosure rate in Oregon that we have in other parts of the country.
Thank you.
I would disagree with that strongly. I would urge you to look at Southern Oregon's foreclosure rate. We've seen a dramatic downshift in home prices and foreclosures in the last 3 months that are off the charts.
Okay.
The California influence.
No.
It's not happening in Portland.
Well, Portland's not the entire state there.
Well, so. It's only half.
Okay. Enough of that. Go on here. We'll try to not fight here.
A couple of the other pieces that were in that bill, it extended the itemized deduction for mortgage insurance premiums. And also within the bill, it extended or excluded certain benefits for volunteer firefighters and EMTs. And I'm not sure exactly the history of how that made that into a mortgage debt bill, but it's in there.
The sausage factor. Okay.
Yes.
Pork sausage. Okay, go ahead.
And both of those are through 2010.
Okay.
The fourth bill there, the Tax Increase Prevention Act, in its original form had a number of one-year extenders for provisions that were sunsetting on December 31st, 2007. And it was a fairly extensive bill in terms of these relative smaller provisions, if you will. In the end, it was just the AMT.
The AMT
one-year fix. And I'll talk a little more about the AMT later, but this, all it did, or what it did, was increase the income exclusion for the AMT for tax year 2007 and preventing a lot of taxpayers from going into the AMT in 2007.
But it's still fair to say that we have a lot more going into that system than we had, say, 10 years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
Much
yes.
More.
Much more. Okay.
Well, Okay.
Go ahead.
And then the last bill there is the Tax Technical Corrections Act, and I'm still going through this. And the feds didn't score this, so I'm not sure that it has any revenue impact. It appears to be very technical corrections to recent legislation passed at the federal law, but I'm still going through that to see if there is any revenue impact. Right now, it doesn't look like that there is. So the upshot of all of the, at least these bills, and I'm still conferring with Legislative Council, Department of Revenue, to make sure that if there are any other bills. But the upshot is, as Paul said at the beginning, there don't seem to be any large pieces of legislation in terms of revenue impact and as in terms of driving a reconnect. But what does drive the reconnect are the smaller provisions, which can be very important for individuals and for businesses in terms of their bookkeeping. Because when the state doesn't tie to a given year. So, for example, right now we're tied to federal law as of December 31st, 2006. So when taxpayers come to file their 07 return, to the extent that federal law changed but Oregon didn't tie to those connections, they have to keep two sets of books for certain aspects and then file two different returns. They'll file the federal return under federal law for 07, and then when they file the Oregon return, they may have to file things differently. And then if in 09, for example, the legislature were to come back in and you were then to update that reconnect through December 31st, 2008, then the taxpayers would have the option of going back and filing an amended return for 07. Mm-hmm. So by not connecting, it creates this complexity for taxpayers and their accountants and businesses. And so that's arguably a strong motivation for reconnecting to the law.
Like reconnecting in what regard? You just across the board?
Well, generally, the Assembly would need to reconnect as of a specific date. Mm-hmm. In recent history, that has been December 31st of the prior year. Mm-hmm. If memory serves, and Paul may know better than I do, but it doesn't have to be December 31st. I believe there have been times in earlier sessions where in the middle of a regular session, the feds passed a significant tax bill, and then the Assembly would have the option of reconnecting as of the effective date of that bill.
So the reconnect obviously couldn't be in a date that preceded the federal action.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, you have a constitutional responsibility for policy, so you couldn't pass something prospectively until you know what it is.
Right.
So that's the requirement. But Chris is right. We did in the 03 session connect to some changes that were made during the regular session. And that was incorporated into the reconnect bill at that time.
I did a lot of things in 2003.
Mm-hmm. And there's also, of course, been some major areas where you haven't connected. So that's always a
Mr. Chair.
Policy choice.
Madam Chair. Sorry.
Senator Monroe.
Strikes me that this would be another good argument for annual sessions, because this would give us an opportunity to do the reconnect before all of the tax returns are done in a dual way and then have to be undone.
Mm-hmm.
I know my accountant always, every time I go to see her, keeps saying, well, make sure you stay connected to the federal, because otherwise it's just a mess. So it strikes me that if we are in fact going to connect to some federal changes, that the February special session would be a good time to do that, prospective or effective December 07.
Right. And that's what our reconnect bill is for. But this year, there's not a lot to do in it. So. Okay.
Well, and if I could add to that, there would be, I guess there's always the potential that the feds could pass something before the February session is out. And because there are a number of issues they were hotly debating all the way up through December. Mm-hmm. And that would be another thing to keep in mind. Now, the timing of that may not work out, but that's something of a wild card.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got it. We've got a vehicle if we need it. At least we'll have a vehicle if everybody shows up on Thursday. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, the second half here, I just wanted to talk about some of the federal sunsets that could be spurring some of the discussion at the federal level and how they might play into federal legislation that could affect Oregon. The first one there are the provisions that sunset on 12/31/2007. So these have officially sunset as of now. And three of the most often talked about ones are the sales tax deduction, which doesn't really affect Oregon. And that's for states that have an income tax or a sales tax, they're allowed to deduct off their federal taxes, their sales tax. And then the other two are teacher classroom expenses and qualified tuition expenses. And these are both above-the-line deductions so that taxpayers can claim them even if they use the standard deduction. Those have sunset for 07. And in recent history, Congress has extended these for 1 or 2 years at a time and not made them permanent. And so I separate those in terms of provisions that have indeed sunset. So if they want to continue that policy, they will have to do something.
Okay, but on the sales tax deduction, you said it doesn't affect Oregon, but doesn't it affect Oregon in the sense that if a Washington resident who works in Oregon chooses to deduct their sales tax instead of their income tax, then that would have an effect on Oregon. Is that correct?
I believe they're required to add back for Oregon, like even for your residents, for their Oregon taxes, we are not allowed to claim our income tax deducted at the federal level. So you have somebody living in Clark County working in Portland, they have the option of deducting their sales tax or income tax. And if they, for example, deduct their sales tax, when they file out their Oregon return, they have to add back both either the income tax or the sales tax that they deducted at the federal level. So for Oregon tax policy, that deduction is not allowed. Now, I believe, and Paul probably remembers this, I believe when that first passed, there was a time period there where they were claiming their sales tax deduction because that had been, that issue hadn't been addressed when that sales tax deduction was introduced at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And then in 03 or 05, I think, there was legislation passed here that addressed that.
Okay. All right. I didn't know that. Okay.
So those are just, that's kind of that category. There are a number of other smaller provisions. And again, when I say smaller, in terms of number of taxpayers and revenue impact. The next block there, are provisions scheduled to sunset in the near future. These are generally, if not entirely, provisions that as a result of the federal tax reductions that were introduced in 01, 02, 03. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, these all sunset December 31st, 2010. So no federal legislation needs to occur in 2008 to change these policies, but we're getting closer to that deadline when the feds will need to take action. And also, going into 09, as you start to budget for the 09-11 session, if the feds haven't taken action on these, that can have a not insignificant effect on Oregon revenues in terms of what that forecast will be in terms of projecting what the feds will do with some of these laws, because these are broad enough that changing them does have an effect on Oregon.
So, for example, if some of the tax breaks are sunsetted and so people pay higher federal taxes, then that would have a negative revenue impact on us.
Yes.
Correct. Yeah.
Yes, Madam Chair. And just to quickly run through those, the federal tax brackets and rates, right now we have six brackets, and the rates are 10%, 15%, 25%, 28%, 33%, and 35%, and those go through 2010. And so on beginning 2011, we go back to five brackets. The 10% bracket goes away, and it's a 15, 28, 31, 36, and 39.6% bracket. So that would be a significant tax increase at the federal level under mm-hmm. current law. The child tax credit is currently $1,000, and in 11 it's scheduled to go back to $500. It'll fall back to the pre-01 level. The joint filer provisions, these are often referred to as the marriage penalty provisions as well, and that is, in comparison, the joint provisions versus the single provisions. The right now, the joint standard deduction is twice the single standard deduction, thereby eliminating that piece of the marriage penalty. And the 15% bracket is twice the width of the single 15% bracket, thereby eliminating the so-called marriage penalty. But those are also scheduled to sunset at the end of 2010. Capital gains and qualified dividends tax rates at the federal level, they actually changed in 08. They are 0% and 15% at the federal level for individuals who are in the 10 or 15% federal tax bracket. Their capital gains are not taxed for the next 3 years, and those in the for income above the 15% bracket, it's taxed at 15%. Now in 2011, those default rates go back to 10% and 20%, and qualified dividends are taxed as regular income. They don't receive that preferential rate. So that's another significant issue. The Section 179 expense, as I mentioned previously, right now it's at $125,000 in index to inflation. In 2011, it will go back to its pre-01 level of $25,000 and not indexed to inflation. And then the last piece I put on here is the federal estate tax, which there are I'm not going to go into those issues. I will quickly defer to Mazin if you have any questions on those. Suffice it to say, in 2010, the federal estate tax goes away, but in 2011, it comes back in its pre-2001 level. So there is a significant tax difference between passing away in December 31st, 2010 and January 1st, 2011.
So you need to buy those vitamins.
It's a plan now.
All right.
The last piece here ties in a bit to what Senator Atkinson was referring to, and these are other issues that were being debated at the federal level and are still on the table, so to speak. There was a bill, I'm blanking on the name of it right now, that dealt with a variety of military tax breaks for veterans. And they were very close to agreement at the end of December, but they weren't able to reach an agreement. Examples of some of the provisions that they're talking about there are including combat pay as earned income and allowing active duty individuals to receive distributions from flexible spending accounts. A lot of these relatively minor provisions, no major in terms of entirely different tax structure, but small tax breaks. The feds are also talking about tax compliance, and within this, they are discussing ways to address the tax gap and tax shelters. The tax gap, one thing that they are discussing is requiring annual reporting of business credit card payments as a way of identifying the income of businesses by looking at their consumption patterns via the credit cards. There's talk about addressing some tax shelters, making offshore accounts a little bit more difficult to use and entering into conversations with so-called tax haven countries to make some of the accounting there more transparent to address some of the shelters. There was a farm bill that they were discussing, and in that there were a lot of energy provisions related to, so those kind of overlap. Provisions there relating to fuel credits and depreciation schedules and things of that nature. And the last one is the alternative minimum tax, which continues to be an issue because they keep introducing these one-year fixes. And just by way of background, you have the regular tax system and the alternative minimum tax, and One way to think about it, that at least helps me, is that you have the regular tax system. Every taxpayer is subject to both systems in a conceptual sense. And you determine your regular tax, and it will be this level, and then you can determine your AMT. And for most people now, the AMT is less than the federal tax, and most people don't even fill out the form, and they're not even aware that it's part of the system. But for taxpayers where the AMT is higher than the regular system, that's where they fall into the AMT. And the biggest factor as to why people are potentially pushed into the AMT is the exemption amount. The structure of the AMT is, in a sense, it's a broader base and lower tax rates, or a more simplified tax rate structure. And it's just two brackets, a 26% bracket and a 28% bracket. And you have an exemption amount that for joint filers is $66,000, and for single filers it's around $44,000. So then above that, for the next $175,000, it's taxed at 26%, and then everything above that, it's taxed at 28%.
Does that exemption include capital gains, like if you sell a house or something like that?
For the most part, the capital gains provisions are apply to both. So yes, okay. The favorable treatment of capital gains for the most part is part of the AMT as well.
Hmm.
But the thing that causes the source of a lot of the controversy is, one, those exemption amounts aren't indexed to inflation, so they've stayed flat. And Congress, rather than indexing them or changing them permanently, they go for these 1-year fixes that saves a lot of people from getting pushed into that. But most of the broader base under the AMT is due to three factors, three deductions at the federal level: the state and local income tax or sales tax deduction, personal exemptions, and miscellaneous deductions, with the single most prominent one is the state and local income or sales tax deduction. So under the regular system, Oregonians, we are allowed to deduct our income taxes, but under the AMT, we're not allowed to. And that provision and the personal exemption, so larger families who get a larger deduction because they have more kids, say a family of five, they're deducting $15,000 or $17,000 under the regular system, but under the AMT, they lose that deduction. So those are the two largest ways that the tax base is broadened. And I think it's hard to argue that those are the tax planning mechanisms that were the original intent of the AMT. And that's why we get this situation where so many taxpayers can get pulled into it immediately, because the income tax deduction is significant. And under the AMT, taxpayers lose that. And that's what pushes them into the AMT.
Complicated
Madam
stuff.
Chair?
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I've read some articles on this, and I happen to be one that gets pushed into that. The original intent, I understand, of the alternative minimum tax was to get some very high income people that somehow were avoiding paying any or very much taxes, and so it was a way of kind of making sure that everybody pays some taxes. But over time, more and more middle income people have been forced into the alternative minimum, so the number of people paying the alternative minimum has gone up dramatically in the last decade or so. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, that's correct. If I don't have the figures in front of me, but if memory serves, in the first year of the AMT, the number that comes to mind is 169 taxpayers, but a couple hundred taxpayers. And then by 1970, it was 20,000 at the federal level. And currently, we're at about 3.5 million federally.
Yeah.
And that's in 2007, the projections were about 23 or 24 million taxpayers would be pushed into the AMT. And it is primarily, and getting at that middle income group, it's the income group that gets pushed into this are, roughly speaking, $100,000 to $500,000 of income. And the reason for that is largely the tax rates. Again, the AMT, the top rate is 28%, and under the regular system, even now, the top tax rates are 33% and 35%. So once individuals have enough income taxed at 33 or 35%, their AMT is still lower than the regular tax system. So it's kind of this $100,000 to $500,000 tax income group that pays a lot of the tax. And another thing to add, one of the factors that pushed a lot of people into the AMT were these tax cuts earlier in the decade, the 01 and 02, because you have a system where the regular system, the tax level was here, and the AMT was right here, so they weren't pushed into the AMT. But with the 01 tax cuts, their regular liability was reduced to below the AMT, and so now they're pushed into the AMT. So we see, without any changes in AMT, dramatic increases in the number of taxpayers being pushed into the AMT through 2010. But under current law, with all of those other federal provisions that are scheduled to sunset in 2010 that I mentioned earlier, there in 2011, their regular liability will dramatically increase, and then there'll be a shift out of the AMT to some extent. But then it goes back on its rapidly growing pattern.
But at the end of the day, because the AMT rate is lower than the maximum regular rate, at the end of the day, the tax cut still had an overall reduction in liability. Isn't that true? Or do they actually end up paying more than they would have?
Madam Chair, they reduced it.
Mm-hmm.
It just if one excluded the AMT, it was a larger cut than it really was because it pushed them into the AMT. And this is where, depending on people I've spoken to, is the AMT a separate tax? Is it part of the same system? It kind of depends on how you think about the system. And the way I think about it, and maybe less just because of the modeling that I do here, is that it's all part of the same system, and in the end, taxpayers have to pay the larger of those two determinants. Most people don't pay the AMT. They're not even subject to it. But having said that, even just the paperwork behind it is complicated, because a taxpayer can fill out their 1040, and if certain criteria are met, they're directed to a worksheet in the tax book, and it's a 15, 20 line worksheet. They fill out that worksheet, and at the end of that, the directions say, okay, now fill out form 6251. So you have a lot of people who have to take the time to fill out this worksheet, mm-hmm. and in the end don't have to pay the AMT anyway, so now they've just spent all this time. And then even after they go to the 6251 and start filling out the AMT form, they aren't guaranteed to owe the AMT. So there's a lot of that complexity that is built into the system. And when you look at the reason for people being pushed into this, the loss of the state income tax deduction and mm-hmm. personal deduction, hardly tax planning tools, gets back to Senator Monroe's original point that it's kind of straying. I believe it's safe to say that there's consensus that that has strayed away from its original intent of getting at ensuring that certain high-income individuals with certain tax planning techniques would be able to avoid taxation altogether.
Well, just one final point.
Yes.
I think it's extremely unlikely that these issues that all sunset in 10 and 11 are going to all sunset. I mean, there will be probably an omnibus tax reform package that's going to come out, maybe not until the next Congress and next president, but... some of these credits and so on that are sunsetted obviously are going to be restored. The tax rates are going to be they're going to rethink that. They're going to rethink the balance between the alternative minimum tax and the tax rates. We cannot assume that just because these things are sunsetted that they're going to go away.
That's for sure. Senator Hess.
Paul, do you want to say something?
I just wanted to comment on the other potential issues and kind of remind the members from the 03 session that we're starting to hear discussion about the possibility of some stimulus at the federal level as the national economy softens. I think we'll hear more and more of that kind of discussion. And just to remind you how significant it is, what approach they take. If they can take some approaches that have very little impact on Oregon, even have a positive effect if it's a reduction in the federal tax liability, but they can also take actions that will reduce the base that we connect to. And the example I'm thinking of back in 03, remember the accelerated depreciation. Mm-hmm.
which you had to make the decision, and a difficult one at the time because there was significant revenue impact, was to connect to that accelerated depreciation or not. The decision was made to do that, but it did reduce revenues by over $100 million at a time when your revenues were declining already. So, how the feds go and try to stimulate the economy makes a significant impact on the decisions that you'll have to make.
Senator Hess.
Well, Madam Chair, speaking of 2003, can you give me the status of what we used to call the Hummer tax break?
Oh, I was going to ask that myself. Thank you. This would be under the farm-related tax incentives, tax credit that used to exist for, or I hope it used to be, I hope it isn't still, for SUVs and
huge
anything over 6,000 pounds, isn't that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, I'm a little bit foggy on that one. I believe it's still in federal law.
I think my recollection is it's tied to the expensing, that you can expense a vehicle over 6,000 pounds. And the Hummer, of course, was up to 100,000 in value. Do you remember, Madison?
Madison, would you come up and educate us here? We have at least two people on this committee who are fervently interested in this issue.
Madam Chair, we need a transportation person here.
Madam Chair, Mazen Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. The Hallmark tax was connected to weight and an amount of money, so it's above $100,000 or up to $100,000, and if you have certain weight. And those were supposedly business connected, so it is not something that you buy for your own use, but if it was a business expense.
But the business could be a law firm or a doctor's office, is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Any small business.
And,
or a consultant, or...
Or it could be a
or a lobbyist.
A lobbyist.
Where's Martina?
I don't know about lobbyists. I'm not certain that it still exists in the same way. I'm more leaning towards that. It's because it doesn't generate as much noise as it used to.
Well, maybe you could look into that, and I think we pretty much got rid of it at the state level, but maybe you could look into that, because it would be good to know. Thank you, Madison.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Monroe.
It's interesting, and I appreciate Senator Haas bringing this up, because I've had luncheon meetings and so on with small business people, and they come driving up in one of these humongous things, and they're embarrassed, and they tell me, well, my accountant told me I had to buy it because I get all of this tax write-off for buying this huge truck, and they actually appeared to be embarrassed because they weren't being properly green.
It should be embarrassed, yeah. Senator Monroe. Editorial comment. Okay. Do you have anything left to talk about, Chris?
No, Madam Chair, that was kind of the end of the one-pager.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much. We will move into our next agenda item, which is the reserve fund issues that we didn't quite get a chance to finish this discussion when we talked about the kicker or the rainy day fund earlier, and so we missed Mr. Cheketoff and his group, and so we're going to give him a chance to educate us today. And also, Chuck, before you sign in, if you want to take a couple minutes before or after your presentation, you can just put in a plug for that.
Okay.
I think you'd do a better job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Cheketoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and with me is Mike Leachman, one of our policy analysts. It's a pleasure to be here to talk about the Rainy Day Fund. I will do the plug first so I don't forget, which is many of you probably saw in the paper that the Oregon Health Plan is trying to get back up to its budgeted level of working poor who can get onto it, and they've started they're going to be starting a reservation list, and there's a one-month window of opportunity to get on the reservation list. The department has brochures and posters that you should be, you all are very connected in your communities. I would encourage you to get a hold of the department and help get out the word so the maximum number of people can get on the reservation list, which is a list to then be in a lottery to get to be asked to apply to the health plan. But it's the first open, the health plan now has only 19,000 working poor on it, adults, and it was up to 132,000 back in 1995, and it's a move to get it up into the 20,000 area.
Thank you for that.
So thank you for that. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here, and we're here to talk about the Oregon Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund, our reserve system. I want to begin by saying it was probably the most important fiscal reform that the legislature has done in many years to create the Rainy Day Fund. I was noting the other day that it's so good that even my own legislator who voted against it sent out a newsletter to constituents praising the fund. I mean, it really, really was great that you created it. After the session, however, we were struck by some of the claims, which I think was a little bit of hyperbole about how we were well protected and whether we can be relaxed now if a recession hits. And so we started looking at it and wondering whether can we take the Rainy Day Fund, which we've long advocated, off our to-do list, or do we have to continue to work on it to be protected for a recession. And very quickly we saw that we needed to do some things to change it. We've distributed to you two reports. The first one is called It Better Only Drizzle, Why the Newly Created Rainy Day Fund is Inadequate to Protection Against the Next Economic Downturn and How the Problem Can Be Fixed. And then earlier this week, we released, and we've distributed to you today, a short paper, How Big an Umbrella Does Oregon Need? And I'm going to address some of the technical issues in the structure of the Rainy Day Fund, and then Michael is going to talk about the bigger picture issue of how big does it need to be, which was one of the topics discussed at your last committee meeting. You know, when the fund has a number of provisions in it which sort of reflect that the legislature doesn't trust itself. And I think for the legislature to be better trusted by Oregon voters, you have to engender that and do things to show that you can be trusted. And in fact, you created a rainy day fund with handcuffs, leg irons, and a muzzle on the majority. And that's a problem. And it's a problem that results in the fact that I think if prior to our report, a better only drizzle, if we had polled the 90 members of the 2007 legislature and said, okay, today, about how much money does the Oregon legislature have? If you had to meet today and spend money out of the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, people would have said, oh, $200 or $300 million. We put most of the corporate kicker into it. And the fact is, you didn't. You did, but you didn't, because you have a rule in there that doesn't allow you to spend that money until the 2009-11 biennium. So you left the building, and people were rightly happy about creating the Rainy Day Fund, and there was a lot of hyperbole about we're now protected. But in fact, if in February session, all of a sudden you got a report that we needed $200 million, you couldn't just pass a bill that says, hereby appropriated from the Rainy Day Fund is $200 million. So I'm going to go into that. That reflects the first problem that we identify, which is that it's written that you can only use money that were in the fund at the beginning of the biennium, and the money from the corporate kicker did not go into the fund by July 1, so you can't use that money now. And then the money that gets transferred from the ending balance at the end of this biennium won't be in the fund on July 1 of 2009. So that gets delayed a whole biennium as far as its use. So we think the beginning of the biennium rule on what monies you can use, the first handcuff you placed on yourself, is wrong, and that the fund now is inadequate. Now, we wrote the report, a number of legislators said, well, we can just always come in and change it. You know, we can first amend that rule, right, and then spend it. So it's not really a big problem, Chuck. But, you know, that sort of goes also back to the trust issue. One of the reasons things get put into the Constitution and whatnot is, oh, the legislature keeps changing their own rules, right? And so, you know, design it so it works right, so you don't have to first pass legislation to change the rules that you had. Design it so it works right so you can make the decision to do that. The next one is that you can't spend more than two-thirds of it, which, you know, we note in our report, and the end note is somewhat ironic because, you know, when you created the Education Stability Fund, you immediately drained it, and so now you're saying, well, we don't want to do that to it. But that rule limits your ability to spend it, and it's particularly harsh if you apply the rule in one, you know, a recession can have an effect on two different biennia, as you know, those of you who have been around for the 01 and 03 session. And so if you have it in effect, even if it's okay rule the first biennium, if you had enough money and you could get through it, the next biennium you're applying that two-thirds rule to now what's essentially one-third of the pot. So it shouldn't be used in subsequent. At a minimum, the two-thirds rule should not apply to a subsequent biennium if it was used in the first, because you can have back-to-back recessions, as happened in the early 80s, and Michael will talk about, and a big recession can have the timing of it can affect two biennia. And so the two.
That's true.
That's understood.
Yeah, that was a provision that I particularly liked and asked to have included in the bill, primarily because the recession that we lived through was a two biennium recession. And if we had a rainy day fund, and we had drained it all in the first biennium, the second biennium you have basically the cliff in the second biennium rather than the first biennium. So it makes no sense to drain the rainy day fund in that first biennium, which a legislature would likely do.
Madam Chair and Senator Starr, I understand that, but the problem is one of your protections against, theoretically, against draining it too much is that you have a supermajority provision. You're letting a minority of people stop that. You have a tough supermajority provision to be able to spend the money. And so, and when you get into the second biennium, then you only have one-third of the money. So even if the legislature, you know,
you go into the second biennium and you have no money.
Well, not necessarily. You might. I agree with you that you might. But under your scheme, unfortunately, you have
under
the second
scheme,
biennium.
It's prudent.
You have only two-thirds of the one-third left. That's the problem. And so we think this, at a minimum, it shouldn't apply in the second biennium. We think the legislature can know how to spend it correctly and won't be spendthrift with it if it's an adequate fund. The next issue is...
Hey, Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Just clarifying. So what you're saying is in one biennium, we have to tap the rainy day fund because we've got a downturn. We take two-thirds of it and spend it. You're saying that if the downturn continues into the next biennium, we should be able to access the entire other third.
If necessary, having a two-thirds rule would not, that's right. And you know, I don't like the two-thirds rule. I think there may be reason to spend it, if you have an adequate fund, spend, you know, two-thirds plus a dollar to solve a problem, okay? So I'm not a fan of the two-thirds rule, but if you're going to have it, you should not have it apply two biennia in a row, because it's whether the downturn continues or just the effect of a downturn, there's a lag. You could have a second recession, what's called a double dip. And so for a variety of reasons, we shouldn't do that. The next issue is with regard to the Education Stability Fund. You will recall that was created during Oregon's bleakest moments during the 02 special sessions. And, you know, this might be a little crass. In one way, it was just a way of taking the Education Endowment Fund and being able to figure out how to spend it, give it a new name, and then the legislature back then drained it. Okay. And when it was created, what happened was you said to the voters, approve a constitutional amendment that's going to put 18% of lottery into the Education Stability Fund. And then, unknown, I am sure, to greater than 99% of voters, you statutorily only put in 16.2%. Constitutionally, you're putting in 18%, but statutorily, you're putting in 16.2% because when you converted the endowment fund and you were at a time when you didn't have a lot of money in your pocket, you had this thing called the Oregon Growth Account that was getting money out of the endowment fund, and you had no other way you didn't think you had another way to fund that, whether it was PERS or whatever. And So you kept that provision, that 10% of the money that goes from the lottery to the Education Stability Fund is now going into an endowment, is going into the Oregon Growth Account, which is essentially a venture capital fund. It's tying up the money. And so you're not doing, you sold the voters 18%, you're only putting in 16.2 statutorily. And the Education Stability Fund doesn't earn any interest. And that's like coming home saying to your wife or spouse, I started a Christmas fund, I've been putting in $100 a month, it's been 6 months, I got $600. And they said, well, what about the interest? Oh, the bank gets to keep it. I mean, it's ridiculous on a reserve fund to not, it's just not fiscally prudent, frankly, to not earn the interest from it and have it grow over time. Your rainy day fund does that, but the Education Stability Fund doesn't. And that money is all going to, well, three-quarters of the money goes to the Oregon Education Fund, one-quarter goes to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And then when the Oregon Growth Account, if in fact it ever has earnings, and it hasn't yet, that money goes to a commercialization fund. So the Education Stability Fund should be designed like the General Purpose Reserve Fund, where it's earning interest and growing prudently. Instead of tying up some of the money in an opportunity fund that doesn't produce any money. So that's what we believe ought to happen in the funds. And now I'm going to turn it over to Michael to talk about the problem of the size of the fund. You created a cap on the size, not a minimum amount you need to have. We think there's at least a minimum you need to have to be fiscally prudent and be protected for a rainy day. And instead, you all focused on having a cap, and the cap, as we have noted in the two reports, is inadequate. And I'll have Michael discuss that.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Leachman, Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm going to focus on a couple of charts, in one each in the two reports that we handed out. My basic point is going to be first that I'd like to talk about where we are now relative to what we needed in 2001. And then secondly, dig into a little more deeply about what we need, whether the 2001 recession is really an appropriate one to look at when you think about what size of reserves do we really need. So first of all, if you would please, in the report called It Better Only Drizzle, on page 6, there's figure 3 at the top there. And basically what this chart is showing is our current reserves. And it's showing it relative to what we needed in 2001-03. In that biennium, general fund revenues declined by a little over 15%. Currently, we have about 2% of revenue in our reserves that's accessible to us, given the restrictions that Chuck has talked about. And even if the reserves, this is both the Education Stability Fund and the new Oregon Rainy Day Fund, if both of those combined continue to grow as we expect for the next 8 years, say we avoid a recession for the next 8 years, even at that point, with the current system of restrictions, you would have available to you only about 6.8% revenue, far less than half of what was needed in the 2001-03 biennium. Now, of course, you could lift all the restrictions that you have, and you'd be left with your cap, except for the caps, let's say, so that you'd have an education stability fund at 5%. Let's say you didn't have any money, you found another source of revenue for the Oregon Growth Account. So you have a full 5% Education Stability Fund, and you have, let's say, a full 7.5% Rainy Day Fund that you have full access to. Even then, you're at that point, you've gotten rid of all of those restrictions, you're still at 12.5%, less than what was needed in 2001-03. So, but let's talk about whether the 2001-03 biennium is really an appropriate one to think about. And here I'd like you to refer, please, to the other report, How Big an Umbrella Does Oregon Need? And on page 2 there, is a chart that simply shows what happened with revenue relative to the close of session. So what you thought you were going to have for the biennium going into it relative to what actually came in. And there's some adjustments made here for interim legislative action. And what it shows is that in the early 80s, the double dip recession that Chuck mentioned, revenues declined relative to your expectations by about 6% in the 79-81 biennium. That was the first dip of the double dip, and then 15% relative to your expectations going into the 81-83 biennium. The early 90s recession was a mild one. Population was growing pretty rapidly relative to what you thought you were going to have going into that downturn. Revenues actually didn't quite decline. But then in early this decade, again, we had a recession that hit revenues pretty hard relative to expectations, more than 20% in 01-03, and then close to 3% in 03-05. So, you know, thinking about what your goal should be, setting a goal of at least 15% seems to us reasonable given what's happened in two out of the last three recessions. Again, I want to, as Chuck has said, say that I think, you know, the step that you took this past session in creating the first ever all-purpose rainy day fund was very important, but we need to go further if we're going to be prepared for the next downturn. We think unanticipated revenues are the appropriate way to go there. If you look over the whole history of the kickers, we've spent 3.5% on average of revenues on the personal income tax kicker. If you include the corporate income tax kicker, roughly you're at about 4%. So you could rough out what putting the kickers into your reserve funds would give you as far as a boost. And if you did that in addition to making some changes to the rules about your access to these funds, you could get close to what you might well need in, if not this next recession, certainly one in the not too, you know, in the, it's certainly one in the future.
Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I don't have a question, really. I completely agree with our presenters about the size of the fund. I've argued for a long time. We had a lot of debate and discussion about this in this committee last year. I think that we need to budget for the rainy day fund. I had a bill that said we put 3% aside off the top, not wait till the end of the biennium, not wait till we hope that we have something left over, but that we budget it 3% into the reserve fund. I absolutely agree. Some of us voted against the reserve fund for the very reasons that you're here speaking today, set aside the issue of the kicker. But I absolutely agree that we need to bolster this reserve fund. I think we need to put it in the Constitution because I disagree. Notwithstanding ORS, whatever it is, this legislature can take the money. There's no restrictions, really, even though it says it in black and white in the statute. But notwithstanding, any legislature can do anything they want. And you talk about trust. I don't think the voters will trust this legislature unless we do things in a way that bolsters that trust. So I find issues to agree and disagree with our presenters, but overall I think that the legislature should heed the warning here, and we should bolster our reserve fund. I think taking the kicker is a ridiculous idea, and the taxpayers, if you want to build trust with the taxpayers, I would suggest we not take the kicker because I don't think the taxpayers will go there. But I think there are ways that we ought to be prudent, be fiscally responsible, take money off the top and say that because we know that that downturn is going to come and the reserve fund that we have now is clearly inadequate.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck, first of all, thank you for your advocacy. I want to talk about this 18%, 10%, 16.2 Oregon growth account. Talk to me a little bit about the commercialization fund.
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, I'm not that familiar with it, and I'll have Michael add if he knows more. My understanding is the growth account, which hasn't been filing annual reports like they were supposed to, but hasn't put any money into the commercialization account, but that's what gets all the money. If the growth account earns money, those pay off, it goes into commercialization account. So it doesn't go back into the Education Stability Fund. So the Constitution, you know, is protected in the Constitution, didn't protect the Education Stability Fund. It says 18%, but 10% of that goes by statute into the growth account, and if it does well, it goes into the commercialization account. And then the earnings of the Education Stability Fund go into the education fund and set three-quarters of it about, and then one-quarter into the opportunity grant.
We have Kate Richardson in the audience, if that might be a better person to address.
Right, and my next question was, is where do the funds go after they go into the commercialization fund? But
why don't we focus on other issues, and then we can bring Kate up to address
all
those
right.
issues. Any other questions or comments? Did you have something, Paul?
Okay. And if I may, just, Madam Chair, just we're not against the growth account and money going into the commercialization account. We just think it's not the right funding source, that when you created it in the dire straits of the 2001 recession and you were converting an education endowment fund, which might have been appropriate back then to fund the Oregon growth account, but you just sort of marched it over when you changed the name of the fund, essentially, and gave you access to it for other purposes, that was the problem. And so I think what's needed is another source of funds for the growth account, not the Education Stability Fund, so the Education Stability Fund can fully grow as intended with 18% of lottery and change the law so it can start earning some, keeping its own earnings.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all the work on this. Kate, do you want to come up and say something? And Inga, if you'd like to come up as well, you can, or not.
But I may have to refer to them.
For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, Chief of Staff of the State Treasurer's Office. Madam Chair, Senator Wilson, in answer to your question about the Commercialized Research Fund, historically that's a newly created fund. It used to be the earnings, the declared earnings statutorily went from the Oregon Growth Account. Those earnings went to the Higher Ed Tech Transfer Fund. That in the last session was changed to be the Commercialized Research Fund. That fund has no money in it, but that the purpose of at this time, but the purpose of that is to provide grants and loans to commercialized research, especially at the universities. In the statute, any money that comes to the Commercialized Research Fund from earnings of the Oregon Growth Account must be used for public education. That goes back to historically the tie of to the Education Endowment Fund. I do want to speak to one of the reasons historically the treasurer, as you know, was involved in the change of the Oregon Endowment Fund to the Education Endowment Fund to the Education Stability Fund, and that constitutional amendment, as was the House Revenue Chair, and advocated for that out in when it was on the ballot. One of the reasons that there was a policy choice not to make changes to what happens to their earnings on the Education Endowment Fund was that it would disturb funding to the sources that was already providing, for instance, Oregon Opportunity Grants, debt service, and the flow of funds also that went to the Oregon Growth Account. One reason the Oregon Growth Account sat under the Oregon the Education Endowment Fund was for a constitutional reason, in that it can hold equity. The Education Endowment Fund and the Education Stability Fund has a constitutional exception. There's a limitation in the Constitution on the state holding stock or equity, and that was one reason, is that the Oregon Growth Account can hold an equity position, and actually that's kind of the goal, is you're going to hit big You're going to fund early, seed money, and you're going to hit big on some of these. And then when the company goes public, you'll hold that stock. So that was the reason at the time that the Education Stability Fund was created, that the Oregon Growth Account wasn't just picked up and moved elsewhere. It was a constitutional reason it's under that umbrella. I have a chart of the flow of funds that to which actually Chuck was speaking about where which money goes. And I also have a draft kind of report of the most recent Oregon Growth Account. It just hasn't, our auditors haven't picked through the numbers yet, but it's essentially there.
Could you share the chart with us?
I'm happy to share those with you now, and this probably isn't the time to get into the whole policy discussion, but I did want to let you know what the background was in answer to Senator Westland's question. If there's other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
And, Madam Chair, if I may, there's been some opinions expressed, and this is just a kind of circumstance of history. We established Education Stability Fund. A portion of that was the Oregon Growth Account. Then we hit hard times, drained the Education Stability Account, so the only thing left in the Education Stability Fund was the Oregon Growth Account, and people start looking at that, and they go, oh, my God, the only thing in the Education Stability Fund is this functionally venture function that's really not a rainy day fund. And so it's not like we weren't sensitive to an actual stability and savings function for education. It just, from the 2001-2003 recession, the Oregon Growth Account assumed a much larger percentage of that asset base. I mean, that's functionally where we got to.
And this is going to be an issue most likely in the 2009 session. I really didn't envision a detailed discussion today, but since it came up, I wanted to give you a chance.
To add one point, if I may, Madam Chair, that during when the Education Endowment Fund became the Stability Fund, the monies in the Oregon Growth Account are also part of that, and the legislature did reach into the Oregon Growth Account and remove uncommitted capital.
Right.
They did force into committed capital, but they did remove money from the Oregon Growth Account to use as a rainy day fund source.
Inga, did you want to add anything?
I don't, for the record, Inga Deckard, and even though I'm sitting here next to Kate Richardson and have been wearing the hat for the last 7 years of being in the treasurer's office, I think all of you know that I'm with Tonkin Torf now. We represent several clients who receive Oregon Growth Account funds. And I know that this discussion is going to continue into the 2009 session. And from our perspective, I guess we would just caution that we take it slow. There are the legal issues that Kate just mentioned, as well as sort of the bigger picture of the legislature in the past several sessions being very strategic about making early stage investments here in Oregon and this economy through the early version OCED, the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, and its latest iteration, the Oregon Innovation Council, and making sure that along the continuum, we're investing money early to pull research out of the universities, commercialize it, create companies, create jobs, and the OGA just occupies one small space along that investment continuum. And so as these conversations go forward, we want to look at that larger framework because a change to that could have a ripple effect all the way down, and a lot of people have done a lot of hard work to sort of set that framework in place. So.
Thank you for adding the questions, comments. Okay, thank you very much. I think we're a little ahead of schedule, and I think we'll take a 7.5-minute break, and we will be back here at 10:45. bring the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee out of recess and go on to our last agenda item today, which is a series of informational items, starting with the update on Revenue Department administrative issues. Mr. Warner.
Madam Chair, we asked the Revenue Department to provide you with some information on a couple of things. One was on the kicker refund process, which recently completed by December 15, as required by statute, and to ask them in terms of administrative costs. They had an issue in terms of contributions to the state school fund that came up that was controversial. And also they were administering the program differently in the past, where you changed the base from a percentage of after-credit liability to a percentage of pre-credit liability. So they're going to, Deborah Buchanan's going to address those issues and how the department managed that process. The second thing is another bill that was passed in 07 was a statute that required withholding on real estate sales by non-residents that have potential Oregon income tax liability. And the department has just completed their rulemaking process, and Deborah will also talk about that. And then you have a panel that will follow that of basically financial institutions that have been working with the department on that rule.
Okay. Why don't we start with you, Deborah, the woman of the hour, and talk about the kicker refund process with particular attention to whatever happened to all those mysterious school fund contributions.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I have provided you with a two-page handout just going through some of the issues that we ran into. And as staff mentioned, the change by the 2007 legislature in the base of the calculation did cause us to do some additional programming this time. And even before the session was through, we had started on this project to make sure that we could get those out by the December 15th deadline. So again, we one of the issues is that when we do that, we have to stop processing 2006 tax returns because we have the calculation going on at the same time as we are processing the returns. So for people who filed their returns perhaps on extension in August or September or October, those taxpayers didn't have their returns processed during a certain period of time, and that was from November 3rd through December 4th. So they were waiting if they had refunds coming to them for us to finish the kicker process and process those returns. And then also we had to, because of the difference in the base, we needed to do manual processing on about 14,000 returns. We couldn't do it through our automated process. Someone had to actually look at that and calculate what the tax was, because there may have been an amended return or there may have been adjustments that we made to that return.
And this is all because of the change we made in how the tax credit is computed relative to the quicker.
A part of it is because of that, but even without that change, we would need to stop processing returns to calculate a kicker. So even if you hadn't made that change, processing would stop for a certain period of time. Also, the checks, we printed about 1.4 million checks, and we do try to mail those out on a designated mail date for security reasons. We don't want to publicize the date that those are going to be mailed because we think there is a likelihood that there might be some theft of the checks. So the mail date is kept secret, but the checks are printed and stored at the state printing. We did have a little bit of an issue this year because there was a mix-up, and some checks were actually sent out in advance of the mail date, scheduled mail date, about 1,200 checks. So people received those, took those to the bank. Some banks refused to honor them, and that caused some issues for those taxpayers because they may have been overdrawn. But so that was a little bit of an issue for us.
So the date was wrong on it.
The date, they would have been post-dated checks that they were trying to deposit. We had about 85,000 kicker checks returned to us because we had bad addresses. Now, keep in mind, what happens is checks go out, obviously, much after the return has been filed. So the return comes into us in April with an address. That's the address that we use if they haven't changed it with us. Those go out, and they've moved, and they're living somewhere else. So we get calls. Number one, is the check going to be forwarded to us? Yes, if you have a change of address with the post office, we will forward it. If they haven't done that, then the checks will come back to us. We have to reissue them, and that, of course, results in some increased cost to us as well. And we're still working on getting those checks out that have been returned because of bad addresses.
So how do you find the new address?
If they haven't, well, we get a lot of calls.
Oh, I suppose. Yes, you write it down when they call.
Yes, we do. We change
question.
It when they call.
Let's move on.
Yes. Garnishment orders. We receive garnishment requests for kicker checks. It, again, has a lot of publicity, so people know that these checks are going out, so we receive these garnishment requests. And as long as the funds are in custody of the state, we're required to honor the garnishments. If you can imagine 1.4 million checks sitting on pallets in a warehouse and we receive a garnishment order, we need to go try to find the check. They are sorted in zip code order, but it's very difficult for us to comply with this. In fact, we ended up paying garnishments, about 500 garnishments that we were not able to locate in those stacks of envelopes. And I believe that we probably will come back to you in 09 to say, this is an issue for us, and ask you to look at that garnishment process and see if we can put some efficiencies in that so we're not spending resources doing that.
It sounds like you need that. Yeah.
Then also, other state agencies were impacted by this as well. We sent out notices to taxpayers whose kicker checks were offset to pay state debt. On that notice, there's a telephone number for the tax court if they choose to appeal. Our phones very often were busy when taxpayers called in to ask about their kickers. If they had that notice in front of them, they might be calling the tax court even though they didn't want to appeal. So the tax court saw some impact from this. Even Fish and Wildlife was getting calls about kicker checks. They were looking for any state agency they could call to ask about kicker checks.
You're too busy working on Snowball to handle kickers, huh?
That's right. And then, as you mentioned, the issue with the state school fund donation box was very significant, this process. One thing that lends itself to the confusion here is, again, when the taxpayers are filing their 2006 return, if they're filing in April, for example, at that time, it's not even determined for sure that there is a kicker. I mean, people expect it, but it's not fixed. The amount isn't fixed. The percentage is not fixed. So a person is looking at this return, and even if they decide they want to make the donation, they may be looking at their past experience. It could have been a $30 or $40 kicker, and they say, yes, I'd like to do that. And yet when it actually comes out, they're looking at a $1,500 donation. So some people probably check the boxes and change their mind. Some people may have checked the box using software and didn't realize they had checked the box. We have had people say they did not check the box. They know they did not check the box, but what we receive shows the box checked.
Did you ever get to the bottom of that, of what, if there was anything to that?
We worked with the software companies. The software companies looked at their systems, and we've not been able to determine that there was a problem with the software or with the electronic filing. And yet we have what we think are credible people saying, my copy of the return does not show the box checked. Our copy does show it checked. And because of that, we did put in a process for those taxpayers to come in and certify to us that they did not check the box. And if they send us that return and it shows the box not checked, we have a process to issue kickers for those. Now, we've received under that process about 900 claims, and we've determined that about 300 of those claims are valid. That is, the return shows the box not checked.
So they basically run the return on the software. They print out one copy for you, and or they send one to you electronically, and then they print out a copy for themselves. How does that work?
Madam Chair, the taxpayer uses the software to calculate the return, and then they send the return, the federal and the state return, to the IRS electronically. We don't have a standalone electronic filing program with Oregon. It has to go through the IRS. So they send both of them to the IRS. The IRS keeps its information, and it sends the state return to us. So what has happened is the information coming to us from the IRS has the box checked, But if they print out their copy of the return, it does not show the box checked. And that's what we heard from a few taxpayers, that that was what was happening to them. Now, we have had taxpayers, too, send us copies of the return, and the box is checked. But what they are saying is they didn't intend to do that. Now, the words in the statute don't allow us to issue kicker checks there. It says once you've made the election, you can't change it. And the position that we're in is if our records show it's checked and their records show it's checked, they made the election even though they may not have intended to do that.
Okay. So no software problem. Okay.
We have not found a software problem.
So you got 900 of these back under your under your process, and you granted 300 of them.
We are still working. We haven't actually sent out any checks yet, but we have looked at them and determined that there are about 300 that appear to be valid. The rest of them run the spectrum from people sending us in forms that are totally unrelated to the kicker. We're actually getting original 2006 returns from people that apparently forgot to file with us, or so that's good. But we're also getting we instructed people that what they need to send in is the return showing the box not checked. And I do just want to mention we received one from a gentleman who said he had the return, the box was checked, and he said, I realized that this is not going to get me my kicker. And I realized that I could send you one that has it not checked. But that would not be honest because my return was checked, even though I didn't intend to. So we're looking at this and saying people we think are basically honest. And there does appear to have been some sort of issue that resulted in those not being checked for the taxpayer but being checked for us. And that's just what we're trying to deal with. And if I may, I don't know whether there's interest in doing anything in the 08 session, but perhaps in the 09 session we might come in and make some suggestions about some changes that could minimize this in the future. I think as long as you have a check going out, there will be some issues. But one of the things that we have brought up that you might consider in 08, and this may not happen, but even if it happens to just two or three people, could be difficult for us to deal with, and that is we had a casualty with the flooding late in 2007. When that happens, people are may be entitled to take casualty losses on their returns. They can, under federal law, either take that loss in the year it occurs, which would be 2007, or they can go to the prior year and amend the prior year and ask for a refund of tax paid in the prior year. So for the people, and the logic there is if your business is wiped out, you may not have income after that. So there's nothing to offset the loss against. So let them go back to the earlier year when they had income, paid some tax, take the loss then. So here's the scenario. Let's assume that for 2006, I filed my tax return and I had $10,000 of tax for Oregon. I then received an $1,860 kicker. And let's assume that I was one of those that inadvertently checked the box, or I don't remember checking the box, but somehow my kicker went to the state school fund. Now, I had this casualty in 2007, and I want to amend my 2006, and it's going to wipe out my liability completely. So I amend that. I ask for my $10,000 back. Here's the problem. I received an $1,860 check that was donated to the schools. So the Department of Revenue may have to look at that and say, yes, you had $10,000 that you paid, but we're going to take that $1,860 because you elected to donate it to the state school fund, mm-hmm. and we're going to reduce your $10,000 refund by that donation. So it's kind of just rubbing salt in the wound that here you have a person that not only didn't get their kicker, but now we're going to reduce that $10,000 refund for the kicker that they did get and donated to the school.
Well, but if they did get their kicker, though, wouldn't they have to give it back anyway? Because if they have no tax liability, they have no kicker.
Madam Chair, if they had received the $1,860, then yes, it would have been adjusted and their refund would be reduced.
Offset
but
by
they,
that amount.
Yes, mm-hmm. but they would actually have received that money. Mm-hmm. In this case, they didn't get the money. It went to the school, yet we're saying
It's as if you received the money and we're going to reduce that $10,000 refund. We may not see any, but it's one of those issues that would...
Wait, I can't imagine many people would fall into that category, but
It's just because of the disaster and the floods on the coast that we're thinking that there could be a possibility of that. And if there's a possibility of doing legislation in 08, we might ask you to take a look at perhaps an amendment to a bill.
Okay. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, back when the kicker program first started, we used to give it as a credit against your next year's taxes. Would that simplify, if we went back to that system, would that simplify and solve many of these problems?
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, the calculation of it as a credit on the return does take care of a number of the issues. And you might recall that it is still a credit for corporate purposes. The state school fund donation box is on the corporate return. So it applies to both individuals and corporations. But the difference is the box is on the corporate return. If they check the box there but also calculate a kicker and take it as a credit, we just ignore the fact that the box is checked. So it's like they didn't mean to do it, or they're overriding it, or they're revoking it. But a number of the issues would be resolved if it were a credit.
So that would work the same way for individuals if we went back to it being a credit. If somebody checked the box, I want to give this to schools, but they also deducted it from their tax liability, then you'd honor the deduction and not the donation.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, I don't know why it would be any different. Right. There are other things that we might consider recommending, perhaps putting in a dollar amount that they have to indicate the maximum that they're willing to contribute. Perhaps they have to do something more than just check the box to indicate that they want to do that. We're looking at what we can do administratively and with the software companies to help minimize it, but we may need to ask you to consider some legislation in 2009.
Thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Okay. And then also, Madam Chairman, there's some statistical information about the checks that went out, number of checks issued, how much was offset to debt that the department collects. And then just as a comparison at the bottom of the page, there were some comment about the doubling of the donations to the state school fund, but if you look at the trend over the last few years, since the time that was enacted, in 2002, 8,800 taxpayers were willing to donate a kicker. Of course, there wasn't one, but they were willing to donate that. 2004, that was almost $11,000. So the fact that we had 11,699 in 2006 doesn't seem to be really out of line for that. And, Madam Chair, unless there are questions, I believe that's all I wanted to comment on.
Okay, any questions on this one before we move to the other one? Okay.
Thank you.
Next subject. Why don't you just segue into that?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Deborah Buchanan with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And you have a handout on this one as well. There are several forms and instructions in case you need to do some reporting. House Bill 2592 again put into place a withholding requirement for certain taxpayers who have real estate sales for Oregon property, and this applies to non-residents or to C corporations that are not doing business in Oregon. And I do want to acknowledge the assistance the department has received from industry representatives in developing the rules and the forms and the instructions. It's been invaluable to us. We very much appreciate it. And we did run into some issues in doing this, as sometimes happens when you have a new program, but the forms are out there now. They're on our website. We do have an administrative rule also on our website and filed with the Secretary of State. I also know that there have been some issues identified that perhaps you might want to consider in the 08 session, some technical corrections and clarifications. But
I understand you're working with the industry folks that have been helping you on the rules on that, on those proposed technical fixes, and are you all pretty much on the same page at this point?
I think we are, Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Anything else you want to add on?
Not unless there's some questions.
Okay. Questions? All right. We'll bring
Thank
up
you.
Our panel.
Thank you.
Mr. Sherman, Mr. Martinez, and Mr. Monroe. I don't see Mr. Monroe. There he is. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Happy New Year to you and the committee. We all look forward to seeing your smiling faces for 27, 28 days here in a few weeks because we think we are bringing to you an issue that the special supplemental, whatever we're calling it this week's session, is designed to address. I'd like to commend the Department of Revenue for working with us on this issue. Mr. Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, Mr. Monroe with the title companies and others have basically spent the last 4 or 5 months dealing with this issue as the rulemaking process went forward. And we're speaking on behalf of the Bankers Association, we're very pleased in the direction the rules have gone. There are some things that they simply cannot do by rules that they need to be fixed legislatively. The three of us met with your counterpart, Representative Barnhart, earlier in this week, and I think he really summarized it quite well. When at least the House committee was dealing with this issue last year, they were kind of looking at the issue from the 10,000-foot level, and they realized that when it got down on the ground, there may be some things that needed to be fixed and amended, and that has indeed proven to be the case. So Mr. Sherman will take a couple of minutes to kind of talk about the issues in a very broad overview. We know your time is limited here today, but since the bill is going to be introduced in the Senate, it will come to your committee, but obviously early in February, and we just wanted to take this opportunity to give you a little bit of background, and we stand prepared to meet with any member of the committee individually that would like more information as we get closer to February. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Tim. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm an attorney here in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Bankers Association. We certainly do appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today to discuss House Bill 2592, which has now been codified as ORS 314258, and to inform you on the work that is now underway, as both Deborah Buchanan and Tim have alluded to, with regard to the regulations, which are now in place, and measure that would accomplish some technical amendments to the 2007 bill. Although that bill was intended to apply only to real estate transactions that involve non-resident sellers, we learned through the rulemaking process that the bill actually comes into play on each and every Oregon real estate transaction that is closed by an escrow company after the 1st of January of this year. And that happens regardless of whether any of the parties are non-residents. And it happens regardless of whether the transaction involves any taxable gain to anyone. In every single transaction, there is a need to interface with the provisions of this new law. We discovered that regardless of legislative intent, the measure could easily be read to require either withholding or the application of an exception, not just to closing, but on each and every monthly payment that is made under an installment obligations. We discovered that implementation of House Bill 2592 would dramatically increase the cost of closing escrow services as title companies and other authorized agents reprogram computers, spend additional time educating customers on the withholding rule, and we expect that to be a real job just to get people to understand why it is that suddenly their escrow company is withholding money. And then also to store for 6 years what we think are going to be huge volumes. I think Jack has estimated that we have about 250,000 transactions statewide. And if you've got multiple parties in each of those, you're going to have separate records on each of those parties. So we could be looking at a million or more pieces of paper each year that have to be stored and kept in order by some means. We discovered that the vagueness of the definitions in 2592 create questions about the scope of the bill, about when the exemption from the withholding will apply, and how the amount is to be calculated, the amount to be withheld. Representatives of the department have worked, I think, with extreme diligence during the last several months to bring about these rules that have now been adopted. They started that process by creating an advisory committee that was included representatives of the lending industry and the title industry, and they've been just extremely receptive to input, and I think it's been a very constructive process for all of us. But throughout that process, there's been a growing recognition, I think, on the part of everyone that the existing law needs to be modified to reduce the burdens that it imposes on customers and businesses that serve them in connection with real estate transactions. The Legislative Council is now working on the draft, and we've had one significant meeting with the Legislative Council and with the Department as a part of the drafting process. That will be LC 57. I anticipate that it will be completed either tomorrow or the very first part of next week. We don't have a draft now, but I can briefly acquaint you with what I think will be the features of that measure. First, and I think most importantly, it will leave intact the fundamental requirement that when an escrow agent closes a transaction on Oregon real estate involving a non-resident individual or corporation, the agent will be required to withhold a portion of the transaction proceeds unless one of the exceptions that are already in the law apply. So we're not changing the fundamental purpose of the law. But we are doing some other things. The bill will more clearly define the scope of authorized agents to which the law applies, focusing on the licensed escrow agent who closes virtually all Oregon real estate transactions. It will more clearly define what constitutes a conveyance that triggers the requirement for withholding, excluding from that definition transactions that do not, by their nature, result in taxable gain. There's no point in withholding dollars when there's no tax that's arising out of the transaction. It will more clearly describe how the amount to be withheld is to be calculated, and that's been a huge problem for the title companies, as I'm sure Mr. Monroe can go into in greater detail. It will clarify that the withholding rule comes into play only at the closing of a transaction and not with respect to each subsequent monthly installment payment. It will reduce the paperwork burden on agents by streamlining the closing or the exceptions process, and it will apply to all transactions on and after January 1 of this year, so that we will retroactively wash away the sins that may now be committed under the existing imperfect law. That's just a brief summary. I think it gives you a pretty adequate picture of what we expect this draft to look like, and we look forward to the opportunity to come back and discuss that with you in greater detail. And at this point, I'll stop and respond to questions.
In your discussions with the Revenue Department, you didn't come up with any problems or issues regarding the retroactivity?
Madam Chair, no. In fact, both Legislative Council and the Department of Revenue suggested the retroactivity. Apparently, because this is a tax measure, it cannot have an effective date that is the date it's signed by the governor. It has to wait for 91 days. That's the effective date. But the date of applicability can be whatever we choose, as I'm informed by the Legislative Council. And the cleanest thing to do from our standpoint, and I think everyone's, is to go back to January 1.
So it went into effect on January 1, 2008. Mm-hmm. So if we get it done in February, which is another good reason for having a special session, then we won't have people filing amended returns if it has a tax consequence.
Madam Chair, I would expect that there won't be a lot of amended returns because we're not really changing the substance of the withholding requirements. We're trying to make the bill work more cleanly, but the department did a tremendous job in trying to recognize going in with the rules what those problems were. So I don't see that there will be a huge difference in the actual on the ground. It's just going to be a lot easier to implement.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Mr. Monroe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, and I really don't have anything to add to Ken's comments. Clearly, as we went through the process, we discovered shortcomings in the bill. Given the complexity of the transactions, they're not all simple transactions where there's a single seller and cash is all that's at issue. And As Ken and Tim have suggested, as we work through the rulemaking process, we discovered the problems, and we have really, at least through the last part of that process, been pursuing a parallel process to see if we could come up with statutory change language that would meet both the department's need and the need of those of us who have to implement the statute. And as Ken has suggested, he's given you certainly a flavor for the problems that exist. And as Ms. Buchanan suggested, we think conceptually we're on the same page, and we think that within a week we'll have some language that we'll all be able to take yet another look at to make sure that it comes closer to getting us to where we think we need to go. And hopefully by the time you arrive here in February, we'll be able to jointly come to you and say, please do this.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you for your constructive involvement, and I've been following this process along and look forward to seeing the bill when it comes to our committee, which I assume it will. Senator Hess.
Thank you. I've gone through this process selling property in Hawaii, and I know what a hassle it is, and so I appreciate the need to want to streamline. Question, I always wondered if, when I went through that process, if the title company had some kind of requirement to report this to their state Department of Revenue or the federal government. Is that in the rules, or what happens? What is the responsibility for title companies to report or to push paper toward Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair, Senator Hess, even in the existing law, and this has not changed, there is a very definite requirement on the part of the escrow agent to turn the money over that's been withheld. If there is no withholding, if one of the exceptions applies, then there is no forward reporting requirement.
There's no reporting requirement, not even to say this happened?
No. We have not, there's nothing in the existing law that would require any report be made. There is a requirement in both the existing law and in the proposed revision to that law that the escrow agent accumulate information and retain files that would document the application of an exception if you're not going to withhold. So if you have a withholding because you've got a non-resident taxpayer and it's a taxable transaction, then there would be the filling out of the form and the sending in of the money with that transaction.
Senator Hass, just I guess to add to that, I think as Ken has suggested, there's certainly nothing within the context of the bill that was passed, or to my knowledge, Oregon law as it exists that requires us, let's say, to notify various parties of the existence of the transaction. There are some, and I wish I had one of my title people here, and we will I will find the answer and get you the more specific answer. There are some obligations that we incur to provide information to the IRS on certain transactions.
Okay. More questions, comments?
Madam Chair, if I could just close with this, I just to kind of reinforce what Ken said, our goal here is not to undo the underlying law. Our goal is to make it work. That's been our mission from day one, and I think you have you'll find a receptive house as well. Certainly the chair over there is very interested and wants to make sure this thing works. So
we'll try to get him something quick. Thank you very much. Dr. Warner, do you have any parting shots here? Looks like we're at the end of our agenda.
I don't have any parting shots. Madam Chair, we're starting to sketch out February, so more information as we get that, we'll get to you. The other thing is to remind the committee of the 2:30 meeting next Thursday, and if you'll let us know if that's something you want to participate in by phone, be sure and let either Robin or I know, and we'll set you up on that connection. So as the chair pointed out, this should be a very short meeting for the bill introduction only.
And, Paul, if you could let Senator Morris know about this. I don't know what his travel schedule's like. That would be good. And, again, what we mainly need to know is if anybody can't be here, because we have to have at least four to have a quorum. So, is there any other business before the committee? Any other comments? Okay, we are adjourned.